Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I am Bill Barnwell. Today, it is a slightly different topic and a slightly different conversation here on the show. I know yesterday I saw Austin Rivers came out and said, I can take 30 players right now in the NBA and throw them in the NFL. So this should really be more of an NBA podcast now that we're missing out on all these NBA players who should be in the NFL. So joining me to list all 30 of those players, joining me today to talk about his new book, Hoop Atlas, my old friend from Grantland, Kirk Goldsberry. Kirk, let's start. But before we get to the book, let's start with this. We worked in the NBA. You cover the NBA closely for us at ESPN. Have you given thought to this? Are you listing your 30 players who could just walk into the NFL?
I have given thought to this, Bill. Thanks for having me on. In fact, there's a part of the Hoop Atlas book, not to just plug it right away, where I talk a lot about Allen Iverson. And Allen Iverson was one of the best athletes to ever play in the NBA. But he was also one of the best high school football players in America in his junior and senior years, I believe, in Virginia Beach. They won the state football championship, and he was a punt returner. He scored a punt return touchdown. He had interceptions, and he was the star quarterback. So I have thought about this very recently as I was doing research for this book, and it's out of great respect for how freaking hard football is that I used Iverson's high school football stats and performances to justify the case that he was one of the best athletes to ever play in the NBA. But I also think he might be the best example of somebody, aside from the obvious Charlie Ward or something, that could have actually made the NFL from the NBA. And I think it's a very high standard, but I've thought about it a lot. What about you, dude?
I looked at the Allen Iverson chapter in this book, and my only note is actually stats are bad.
Okay, let me put you on the spot. Which NFL player could play in the NBA?
Which NFL player could play in the NBA? I would say Randall Cunningham could play in the NBA. I think you just get a 99th percentile athlete who basically like had to fight his coaches to play football consistently. I think would be pretty good at basketball is my instinct. But I know someone's going to come out there and be like, oh, this player was a high school star. Like, and I'm going to have totally forgotten them. So it's a really fascinating thing. And I don't really want to get too much into it because I think 30 is silly. But obviously, the athleticism you need to play at a high level in the National Basketball Association is maybe the most difficult task in any sport. Football is, of course, very difficult, but in a different way.
But can I give you your flowers from way back when? Because you actually did the research on this when it was not just a sort of a meme news cycle. And I do think like the staggering height of some of the NBA's best players, like the average height in the NBA is 6'7". I don't know if there's more than, you know, I don't know. There's not a lot of 7-footers. No. They're not built for the NFL physicality. So I do think the subset of players we're looking at is sort of like that Kyrie Irving on the low end up to like the 6'5 guys who are strong and athletic that could play probably positions like quarterback or wide receiver. But even our friend Dominique, who I think embodies like an elite defensive backfield player, he's very small and quick. So some NBA players are just not, and there are not a lot of linebackers in the NBA population. So yeah, I think it's a few position groups that this is a relevant conversation for. And I think a lot of the NBA is simply just too tall. And I remember learning that from your piece at Grantland a long time ago.
Dominique did convert, though, from excellent football player to excellent takesmith. And you converted from college professor to world-class takesmith when it comes to the NBA. So you can succeed in multiple arenas if you have that level of talent. Yeah, legend in two games, many say about you, Kirk Goldsberry. Let's talk about Hoop Atlas, because Hoop Atlas is a very fun book. Now, people know your work. They know when they read something by Kirk Goldsberry, it is going to be smart and it is going to be pretty. What led you to write Hoop Atlas, lay out sort of the broader scope, the broader narrative you present in Hoop Atlas?
Well, thank you, Bill. I appreciate your kind words. The subtitle, I think, does a good job. It's called Mapping the Remarkable Transformation of the Modern NBA. My background is in map making and cartography and data visualization. So there's a lot of charts, as you say. But really, it's the remarkable transformation of the NBA since I've been watching it that drove me to write Hoop Atlas. It's a remarkable time to watch pro basketball. We have just sort of witnessed the game being modernized, and I wanted to capture like the post-Jordan era the way I love to analyze the game. And I think the time was right in the mid-2020s to sort of look back at the Jordan era and what's happened since then and try to sort of describe it as almost an artistic movement and how we got from point A to point B, and importantly, which players, almost in the same way a jazz historian or an art historian would look at influencing artists in movements, which players really symbolize some of the key aspects of this dramatic change in pro basketball in the 21st century.
So, what I really loved is when you start the book, you start with Michael Jordan, who, of course, at this point is as much mythology as actual evidence. Like the there's not really criticism of Jordan that still really exists publicly, even though there's plenty of criticism of Jordan at the time. And I don't think it's a hot take to be like Michael Jordan was not perfect. I don't think it's a hot take to say Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player of all time. But I do think the evolution of Michael Jordan, it is something that has not really been covered. I think we only have the memories of what happened, at least outside of the hardcore basketball universe, the memories of what Michael Jordan was at the very end of his career, as opposed to what Michael Jordan was earlier in his career. And I thought it was really cool that we actually got, we got a Kirk Goldsberry like style look at the evolution of a player we haven't really ever, whose evolution we don't talk about very much anymore. Like what changed about Jordan, and how did that change relative to what was happening in the NBA at the time?
Thank you. I think when The Last Dance came out at ESPN, I really was tasked to dive into Michael, which was one of the thrills of my basketball writing career. As you remember, it was deep in the pandemic, and that's really what spawned this chapter, was we needed content on the website, and there was no sports, and The Last Dance was coming on. And so I wrote two or three big articles about Michael, which again was just thrilling for me. I mean, he's the reason I love basketball. But you're exactly right. Like using 2010s or 2020 style basketball analytics to look back at Michael was fascinating. And number one, you're right. He changed the way he was playing. And that's one thing we'll come back to. But number two, even by today's like hyper efficient standards, he passed the nerdiest tests of the 2020s with flying colors. And what I mean by that is not only was he very active from a volume scoring standpoint, but he was hyper efficient. And I compare him to like almost like Dirk Nowitzki. And I didn't know that he was that efficient as a jump shooter until I was doing these projects for ESPN during the Last Dance era. But yeah, potentially Michael doesn't win those last three championships if he doesn't evolve drastically after the first three. And sort of coming from the 80s, when he was drafted, his reputation was he couldn't shoot. By the end of his career, he was simply the best jump shooter in the NBA. He was able to get shots whenever he wanted, and he knocked them down at elite rates. Now, back then, the best jump shooters in the league really practiced in the mid-range, which has certainly gone. But when you look at Michael's career, and one of the cool things in Hoop Atlas is he made jump shooting cool, but he was also very efficient by today's standards. And I really argue in the book that his jump shooting spawned a generation of Kobe Bryant's, Tracy McGrady's, Allen Iverson's, and eventually Stephen Curry's that proved that jump shooters could dominate in the NBA and win championships and scoring titles, MVPs.
Yeah, and you lay out, the evolution of Jordan, how his shot selection changed, how efficiency and effectiveness changed. Really fascinating. And then you go on to Allen Iverson, who you just mentioned, and I know I joked earlier about stats being bad, but you lay out a pretty convincing case about Iverson that, even though the numbers don't necessarily suggest that he was as efficient as other players, whether it be his aesthetic influence, whether it be the degree of difficulty he faced, whether it be his unique style and charisma, that he transformed the game in a different way from Jordan.
Yeah, and I think Allen Iverson is one, obviously one of the more complicated players in the modern NBA's history,
Yes.
And I don't touch a lot of that stuff. Not a lot. You talk about what Kirk Goldsberry articles are, what they're not. I'm not going to get into some of the complexities of Allen Iverson's legacy. I'll leave that to people who cover the sport in different ways. But analytically, he is fascinating. And he really, to me, Bill, epitomizes the key thesis of this book, is that true greatness in basketball is more about influence than banners. And his ability to create viral ball handling highlights and make sort of perimeter movement cool. And again, he's arguably the greatest undersized athlete that basketball's ever seen. But without him, there's no Kyrie Irving, there's no Stephen Curry breaking down defenders. He really brought sort of elite ball handling to the perimeter. And some of his influence is much greater than players that were more successful in his time. And Shaq and Tim Duncan deserve the ultimate respect for what their resumes say they accomplished. But to be blunt, like, they didn't influence future generations like Iverson did. And you can see Allen's fingerprints all over today's best players, especially in the backcourt. And his ability to take what Michael did and then sort of add this layer of incredible ball handling helps us explain how Steph Curry and Kyrie Irving and some of today's best players are using handles to create absolute chaos in buckets from the perimeter.
So you're what you don't say this, but I think it's strongly implied is that you're saying the professor from N1 was more influential than Hakeem Olajuwon. Is that fair to put to your name?
Yes, then you could put that on my gravestone, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, the professor. But yeah, I think that's like sort of interesting because the viral ball handling highlight did not exist. And, you know, one of the big scenes in the Iverson chapter is the crossover on MJ in his
Yes.
rookie season. And then you follow that up 4 years later with him absolutely destroying Ty Lue in the right corner in game one of the 2001 finals, which is the moment we all remember from the 2001
Yes.
finals. And they lost the 2001 finals. And you wouldn't know that by looking at YouTube highlights from the 2001 finals. You would see
Yes.
this one play and be like, oh my God, that's the star. And that impact has been 20 years felt in terms of how ball handling has become, like dunking, almost this like viral theme in basketball highlights.
When you look at these sort of, I don't want to say pre-three-pointer, because obviously the three-pointer existed for, the majority of Jordan's career. It existed for all of Allen Iverson's career, but it was a different sport in terms of the shots that were being taken. It was a different sport in terms of how often players, especially elite players, were attempting three-pointers, and your work has contributed to that. How do you contextualize those guys? Like how do you contrast them? How do you feel about them? Like, do you think they would have played differently if they were playing in, I guess they obviously would have played differently, but like, is it hard to resist the idea that they're sort of antiquated in a way because they're playing in a less efficient or a more mid-range era, I guess?
Yeah, you have to. And I was actually thinking about this with the heliocentric chapter in the context of Jalen Brunson. You know, Jalen Brunson, you know, we're taping this on a Wednesday morning, and I'm in New York City. He's about to play game two. In his last five games, he scored 210 points, which is the highest any player has scored in a five-game postseason stretch since Michael Jordan 1993, Bill. He's not Michael Jordan, but he is benefiting from smarter offenses, better skill development, and you know, he deserves a lot of credit for this. But what we're seeing is statistics. It's almost like what happened to baseball with the home run stats. Michael Jordan was the best player of his era, it's undeniable. But you know, if is Brunson gonna surpass him in points per game, who honestly, who cares? But you know, we steal a lot from baseball. I know you guys in football analytics kind of do this too. You know, baseball has taught us a lot, and there are different eras in baseball. When I mean, you're comparing stats across eras, you have to be very careful, and that's something that the takesmiths of today aren't really great at. When you're looking at Brunson or Jason Tatum, and they're like, oh, he's doing stuff that Larry Bird never did, or he's doing stuff that Michael Jordan was the last to do, and you're like, the insinuation is that these guys are equivalent almost, and that's just not the case, obviously.
Yeah, and A player who sort of bridges the gap in his own strange way, and a player who had one of the most unique paths to stardom. It's hard to imagine anyone else having the same path to stardom in the modern game, is Manu Ginobili, who comes up quite a bit in this book as well, someone you saw closer when you were working for the Spurs. How did Manu change the game for you, and how did he sort of bridge the gap between like the Jordan and Iverson era and the more modern efficiency era, maybe?
Yeah, Manu and I have an interesting relationship. I mean, I work with him, like you said, in San Antonio, but it's funny, like I used to root against him. He really drove me crazy as a fan
Oh
before I got to
no.
know him. Yeah, I know, but that now he's become my favorite player, and I'm thrilled to talk about him. And again, I'll give you an example of influence. He brought the Eurostep to the NBA. He popularized it. He wasn't the first player to use it in the NBA, but he was the first star player to use it at a very high level in the game's biggest stages and just dominate with it. The day he retired, LeBron James tweeted out, like, thank you for bringing the swaggiest move in the NBA to the NBA, which is the Eurostep. And I mean, it's a funny tweet, but it's also pretty remarkable and indicative of what this book is about, is how one player can reform something about the sport or introduce something that becomes a fundamental down the road and changes the game. Like now Giannis and LeBron are doing the Eurostep, which was not something that was taught to college basketball players in America just 20 years ago. And I think that's really interesting. And Manu to me captures a few of the key themes, not only that sort of disruptive move that changed the game, but he brought it from a foreign place. So to me, he also captures the effect of the globalized NBA and how players like Manu and Dirk and Tony Parker challenged conventions about like American basketball fundamentals and showed us that the best moves are actually not the ones that we're learning in America necessarily. And Dirk is another great example of that. But Manu, my favorite Manu stat is, I think 141 players have played at least 1,000 games in the NBA. He has the highest winning percentage. He was a badass. He won everywhere he played, including beating Team USA in the 2004 Olympics and winning a gold medal against NBA players. But Manu's Eurostep is really, it's hard to pinpoint one specific move that's been more impactful in helping perimeter players take over this league than that one. And he's responsible for it more than anybody else. And that's kind of the exact kind of thing I wanted to capture with this book.
And I think what you really captured that's interesting, it reminds me a lot of I've been reading about because I'm in this exact age group, like the sort of post, how would I frame it? Like post Gen X, pre-millennial group, where you can simultaneously remember what it was like before the internet and also have lived the majority of your life in the digital internet era, where it's possible to imagine there not being an internet. Manu kind of bridges that unique gap in the same way, where yes, he was a foreign player. Yes, he introduced the NBA to something that didn't that was not as prevalent. He was a different flavor of player and changed the game because of it. And he existed, and Tony Parker did this too, in an era where like you could afford as an NBA analyst to be naive about that, to not know what was happening outside of the NBA, not know what was happening in Europe, not know the influence the impact players had. Whereas now, I mean, I guess Victor Wembanyama is like the most extreme example because everyone knew him for several years before the draft. But like, we live in an era now where if you are making noise in Europe, if you are a young player coming to the NBA, if you have a different style, it's going to be accessible. It's going to be something you see, on social media. It's going to be something you see in casual conversation about the NBA. So this star player, this really promising player, is coming to the league. And Manu was not that caliber of prospect. It was not regarded as the caliber of prospect. But people at this, I feel like at this point, people would know about a Manu caliber player entering the league. And it just sort of feels like he was from an era where that doesn't exist anymore, just because the league is more global. The league is it, it's the world is smaller in the NBA than it maybe it was 20, 25 years ago.
That's brilliant. Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. So he he and Dirk Nowitzki and even Luka Doncic were drafted below where they should have been, in part because of this bias against players from overseas, but in part because why would you go scout? And actually, this ties to Melbourne, Australia, and the first time RC Buford even watched Manu Ginobili, it was in Melbourne in I think this under 22 FIBA tournament, and he tells the story about how he was just him and one other guy from Miami Heat in the building, and at the equivalent events like that now, to your point, in 2024, there's 25 or 30 teams there, and it's like it's kind of a poetic sort of thing. But the question is, did Manu and Dirk sort of force people to take these players seriously, or did it happen naturally? I think your point about the internet is also very good, and wish I thought about that more. But yeah, today and today, you know, Luka Doncic, who represents this trend sort of into the 2020s, was also drafted too late, in part because there's still this sort of anti-European bias in pro basketball. I think Wembanyama might represent the final end of that chapter, because there's like, oh, nobody said this. Oh, he's French, he's soft. Nobody said that. But for the vast majority of the 2000s and even the 2010s, you heard this about European prospects. And Wembanyama wins, not only wins the Rookie of the Year unanimously, he appears to be the sort of epitome of where the sport is headed in terms of hyper skilled big men who affect everything on both ends of the court.
And obviously the results for the Spurs were not there this year, but I think that is going to change with Wembanyama in the lineup in the years to come. And it's funny because, you know, we joked about the NBA NFL crossbar comparisons before this. It's funny how often you see the same conversations and same sort of the same xenophobic conversations about players across different sports. Like in hockey, I know our friends from Canada watched Don Cherry for so many years, and so often it was the, oh, well, this Swedish guy or this Finnish guy or this other European guy can't play in the US, can't play in Canada because he's not tough the way Canadian players are. If you watch the Premier League for so long, even players from France, you know, very close to England relatively, let alone players from other continents coming to the Premier League, it was, oh, they're not tough enough to play. Can they do it on a cold Wednesday night in Stoke? The famous sort of meme. You know, that really evolved. That sort of analysis, that conversation does not happen anymore because you saw players evolve, you saw players take over. And I think, you know, to your point, the Spurs' success with Manu and Tony, and you know, the other player, like Luka's success in Dallas, Wembanyama's success in San Antonio. I think it's a really good point to say that it's kind of we're at that point now where it is really you're seen as obviously stupid if you make that point. I'm not following NBA coverage enough to say no one's making that point. I would trust your instincts there, but that is like an obvious, okay, this person should not be taken seriously point. Whereas 10 or 15 years ago, even, you know, that would have been something that at least some people would have held out and said that's a reasonable argument to make. And I think the league has thankfully and fortunately evolved away from that. But it's a, you know, it's a different universe, I guess, than it was when Manu was entering the league.
Yeah, here's the staggering stat to put a button on that conversation is there's a real path where there is not an American-born MVP in the NBA in the 2020s,
Wow.
which is crazy because there was not a foreign-born MVP until Hakeem and then like Steve Nash, and it's a spattering across the decades or whatever. But we could have every single MVP this decade be a foreign-born player who not only was born overseas, but developed their game overseas as well. And I love the point about the EPL. That's where this is heading, and it's good for the sport, right? Like, welcome to being the best basketball league in the world, but basketball is now the second most popular sport on the planet. We're going to have a huge talent pool. And to assume that a huge chunk of that, even a majority of that's going to be an American talent pool in 10 years from now is wildly sort of jingoistic and overly patriotic and foolish. And it's a good thing. Manu brought this, Jokic brought that, Doncic brought this. You know, that's beautiful. And it's made soccer the most popular sport in the world and even better to watch on television. And we hope that we're going to have the same. We could dream to have that, Bill.
Dude, I just passed by a House of Hoops in downtown Melbourne this
Oh, heck
afternoon.
yeah.
It's happening. I will say, last time I passed by that House of Hoops, there was a Matthew Dellavedova life-size cardboard cutout in the window. That is gone. So the Delhi love may have faded from the last time I was here, but hoops still very popular here in Australia. This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better with the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country. There is no competition. And right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, SAVE. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a Jet's Pizza location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's number 8, SAVE. Jet's Pizza, better because it has to be.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You have spoken to LeBron about your work, some of the work that comes up in Hoop Atlas. What were those conversations like?
Yeah, I'll never forget. I remember I went to our bosses at Grantland and I was a part-time employee and something had fallen in my lap because I was still teaching at Harvard and somebody reached out for me from the Heat. And I remember I called Dan Veerman, who was one of our bosses at the time. And I was like, Dan, I think I can interview LeBron James. And this is like, I was like, do you think Grantland would pay for me to go down there? And I never interviewed an NBA player, Bill. So this is, let me put it in time. I
You
think
want
this
to
is,
start. You want to start with LeBron as the first one you want to interview. That seems like
yeah.
it's the logical way to go.
And I'm a professor. I don't know. I'm not a journalist, and I have a lot of respect for that craft. So I call Dan, and I'm like, dude, would you guys pay for me to go to Miami? And he's like, are you fucking crazy? Get on the next plane. And so I went down there, and it was in the middle of their giant winning streak. I think it was a 30 game or 25 game winning streak. I forget the exact number. But long story short, I spent a lot of time with LeBron after a game against the Pistons in, I want to say, 2013. And they were about to win the championships, arguably looking back, the best year of LeBron's career. And I put a bunch of charts in front of him. And the first thing he said is like, that's some unique shit, man. And he'd never seen. And the point there is like, that's funny. And I'm like, I can't believe this is real life. And I'm a professor. And what is happening?
You actually did the smiling through my life. I can't believe this is my life
That was,
meme.
yeah, I'll
LeBron
always
may have stolen
remember
that
this
from
moment.
you.
I don't know if I'll ever have a moment where I'm like that pinch me moment like that professionally. It was like, how is this happening? But I put these charts in front of him. He starts marking them up. Some are still hanging on my wall because I can't believe this happened. He signed one for me. But I think the cool part about that story 11 years later is that LeBron James, clearly the best player in the world at that time, had never seen charts like this. He'd never seen these sort of analytical representations of his own shooting, his teammates shooting, his opponents shooting. And he asked me to keep sending them through the playoffs. And I did that for a year or two. And not a lot of people know that. But some people would see him in his locker room in Miami in the playoffs. And, that was a thrilling moment. But, he's a very, very smart and advanced player. I think that's coming through in the Mind the Game podcast he's doing with JJ. But in this book, Hoop Atlas, it's really a good time to think about his legacy as a participant in the changing of the game. And a lot of people don't realize he's had his hand in the three-point revolution as the dominant player of the 2010s. Of course he did. People think, oh, he's not that great of a shooter. Nobody in NBA history has assisted on more threes or corner threes than LeBron James has. So in the LeBron chapter, not only do we talk about his incredible run to the scoring title, but we look at how his drive and kick game and the best LeBron teams always had dudes like Kyle Korver or Ray Allen or Danny Green in the corners for him. But looking at that sort of symbiotic relationship between his rim attacking, his passing, and these guys in the corners. And to me, that's become a really important part of discussing how the game opened up and how he actually had his hand in the dominant trends of his career. Because when you look at how different the NBA has been when he came in 2003 to where it is now, one of the more remarkable aspects of his dominant run is that he did it in the midst of this metamorphosis of the game turning inside out. And he adapted on the fly. He built the plane in the air as he became, the greatest player of the 21st century. The game was just changing as rapidly as any sport in American history. And he is changing along with it. And in many cases, driving some of those changes, Bill.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say is, you say he adapted, and that's certainly true. Of course, he's a dramatically different player than the guy who entered the league. But I also would, from reading your book, it's very clear that he was the one driving those changes, that it was not just him adapting, but also him creating and the league having to adjust in his image and trying to emulate maybe what his best teams were doing. And then again, it goes back to Jordan as well, where Jordan's teams also had the Steve Kerrs of the world, the shooters, John Paxson. Comes to mind as well as like guys who were, their primary role on those teams was to be spot up shooters when teams were too focused on Jordan.
100%, and one of the so the where you go from LeBron is obviously to Stephen Curry,
Yes.
and who's coached by Steve Kerr, and I don't think that's an accident that this legendary Steve Kerr, I believe, still owns the NBA record for 3-point percentage. He is one of the best, the most talented catch and shoot guys this league has ever seen, and it's when he sort of takes the reins in Golden State where he changes Steph Curry and Klay Thompson's games, because I feel like he knew the 3-point shooting was bound to be a bigger part of NBA basketball than it was when he was winning titles with Michael, and in San Antonio too. So I think it's almost it's a cool way to bridge the gap from Michael to Stephen. Not only are they both from North Carolina, but they have the Steve Kerr relationship, where Steve really opens up the Splash Brothers era with an offense that's specifically designed to create more and more and more clean looks for these dudes from beyond the arc. And that had never been a focal point of an NBA offense. And I think it's kind of lost to many people that it's Steve Kerr who engineered this great 3-point shooter from the 90s. But it's probably my favorite chapter in the book, Bill, is the Stephen Curry one.
Do you feel like Steph and that Warriors team is like the first team that feels like post, post spacing, post people realizing that three's worth more than two, post the mid-range being, taken out of the game? Does it feel like that is the first team to thrive in that era? Or do you think that was like the team that, actually kind of proved, oh, this is how you can play basketball and this is how that this is not just a sort of an idea that wouldn't actually play out well in reality. Like, do you think LeBron proved that, or do you think that was the Warriors teams that had to make that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. I always say that Stephen Curry is going to be the face of this revolution for years and years and years to come. And he did for the 3-point shot what Babe Ruth did for the home run, in terms of turning this like random thing that happened occasionally into the main course of an NBA offense. And he's going to be the face of it. But it's important to note that those Warrior teams use the mid-range, obviously the ones with Kevin,
Of course.
but Sean Livingston. And one of the crazy stats I surfaced this season was the Warriors teams with KD and Stephen, as good as they were from an offensive efficiency, they broke records in terms of offensive efficiency. They'd be below average this year, because that revolution has continued from the middle 2010s to the middle 2020s, and we have sort of continued to arbitrage efficiency in more and more ways. But getting back to this, there is no question in my mind that Stephen Curry is the most influential player of the 2010s. He might not be the greatest player, that might be LeBron James, but when you watch kids play basketball, when you watch Caitlin Clark, when you see where the game was and where it is, it's very hard to assign like this influence category to anybody other than Stephen Curry, who has literally changed the sport forever.
And I actually wanted to ask you about that. Maybe we'll finish up talking about that idea. We've seen kind of a reckoning happen in other sports where there's been some aesthetic concerns. In baseball, you saw this when you know, teams are optimizing for strikeouts and optimizing for home runs. We got a game that had very few balls in play. That led to changes to the baseball. It led to changes to the way the game was played in the hopes of making a game with more balls in play. And that's still very much a work in progress. In football, you know, the lean towards more pass efficiency has led to a game where there's legitimate aesthetic criticisms of, you know, it being a check down game, just a get the ball out, short passing, no, you know, without these sort of exciting deep passing plays that, you know, you would expect from great offenses in years past. Patrick Mahomes this last year won a Super Bowl throwing the average shortest pass of anybody in football. He had to entirely evolve the way he played because teams were so afraid of him beating them downfield, and he evolved into basically the best, you know, short passer in the National Football League, the most efficient short passer in the National Football League to win two Super Bowls the past couple of years. Now that the game has changed, and let's be honest here, like, you're part of the reason the game has changed in terms of the work you've put out there and how influential that has been in terms of, you know, encouraging teams to avoid the mid-range and encouraging teams to hit, to take high percentage shots, like, or shots that have been successful at a higher rate than shots elsewhere on the court, like the corner three. Number one, do you think the game has evolved in a less aesthetically pleasing way for maybe some of the guys you look at from the past? And if you do feel that way, what changes would you argue that the NBA could consider to make the mid-range more relevant? Do you think that's even necessary?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big theme of my first book, Sprawl Ball. And again, I steal from baseball, and hats off to everybody in the baseball community. You guys have led the way analytically and philosophically for people like myself who look at the game with numbers and charts and so mm-hmm. forth. But it's one of my favorite topics of conversation. And yes, I think that Moneyball has done a lot, but the massive intrusion of sort of financial reasoning may not be so well coupled with an aesthetic that is good, right? When you bring finance bros into front offices, is the product going to get more beautiful? Probably not. It's going to get shrewder. It's going to get just hunting for efficiency in any margin possible. And you're exactly right to bring up baseball. And some of my friends at the Major League Baseball League office deserve a lot of credit for implementing rules based on analytics that could create a better product in the face of this analytical revolution. And I do think basketball, a lot of people in the streets are annoyed. And I think offenses are too powerful, sort of too monotonous. And, you know, that's I'm always careful to say beauty is in the eye of the beholder in these conversations. But the game is less diverse now. And in Sprawl Ball, I really attacked that in 2019, and it's only sort of been more and more pronounced as we're getting to the middle part of the 2020s here. And simply put, the thing that needs to change is the three-point line. It's staring us in the face. Every other major basketball league, Bill, in the 21st century, from women's college basketball to the WNBA to FIBA to men's college basketball, you know what they've done in the face of rising three-point rates? They've all moved their three-point line back. The one league that hasn't is the one with Stephen Curry, the one with Damian Lillard, the one with Jason Tatum, the one with the best freaking shooters in the world. And somehow we're just leaving this line there. And particularly the corner three has become the mascot of this to me. Corner threes now represent 1 in 10 shots in the NBA. 20 years ago, they weren't even part of the vernacular. And now you hear like Ian Eagle or you hear Mike Breen talk about corner threes multiple times in a broadcast. And the shot has become way too easy for way too many players, and they're some of the least interesting actions in the game. So that's our check down pass. That is our strikeout. That is our shift. That, to me, is the thing to fix. And that shot's easy to pick on because it shouldn't even exist. It is a shorter three-point shot than many three-point shots in women's college basketball, the WNBA. It's 22 feet, and it's just simply too easy. And it's an easy thing to adjust and make that life harder on them. But ultimately, you're right. And the process that I want to sort of get behind is using numbers to build a better product. You know, Michael Lewis sort of framed sports analytics as this endeavor that one team can use to beat another team. But I think the really interesting application of it that we've seen in baseball is how can we use analytics to shape the product so that the fans love it the most? And I think that's where the NBA is going to have make some tough decisions here in the next few years.
If it was you, if let's say you suddenly become the commissioner of the NBA, what changes are you making, even beyond shifting the 3-point line to the FIBA rules? Is there anything else you're doing to try and create a more diverse offensive game? And do you think that would make basketball more aesthetically pleasing to people who watch basketball on a nightly basis?
Yeah, and in fact, after Sprawl Ball came out, to Adam Silver's credit, it was another thrilling moment. Like, they reached out and asked me, to send them some ideas, and we got pretty far down the road with adjusting the 3-point line, and then the pandemic hit. So it's a conversation I'm looking to restart with them. The obvious thing is moving the 3-point line back to 25 or 26 feet, where the stats, and now we have this super high resolution shooting data that can inform this discussion, Bill. I can show you what percentage of shots go from 26 feet, find the bottom of the basket. What would happen? One of my students at Harvard actually did a thesis if it simulated shot selection models based on different 3-point lines. And that's the kind of thinking we can use. But yeah, I think we want diversity. I think the North Star is we want to use that 800 square foot area called the mid-range. That should probably not be just forgotten land. Yeah, it should not be this flyover country in NBA offenses. But ultimately, the sad thing is, and one of the sort of powerful levers I can do to bring this whole conversation together is the shots that made Michael or Kobe or Dirk famous or Larry Bird are virtually extinct. And do we really want to live in a league where that kind of heritage is just deleted from the modern game? I don't think we do. So breathing more life into that, breathing more diversity into the shot selection thing is a big thing. And yeah, I have a lot of ideas, but I think moving the 3-point line is the most salient one and the most obvious one the league should look at very soon.
And I think it's going to be interesting because, we're going to see, and we already have seen the game below the NBA be impacted by the NBA. Like watching Steph play over the past 15 years, there's way more high school players, way more college players coming up and trying to be Steph Curry and emulating Steph Curry's shot selection than there would have been in the 15 years prior. And I think with the We see this a lot with baseball. Like, we're seeing even junior high kids selling out for velocity. And not that, like, it's always cool to throw fast, but, like, trying to get great spin rates when they can get tested, trying to just max out for velocity because that's what's working in Major League Baseball. And I think that extends to the NBA as well, where, it's going to take time for players coming up to really focus on the mid-range. And I think you have to incentivize that, but it's going to take time. I think this, the league is going to evolve. And the way the league evolves, and the best players on the planet are going to evolve quickly, but the league as a whole, I think even if you implement rule changes, it's going to take time for them to actually trickle down into the high school, college level, and or into the European level. And I think that's, maybe more of an incentive to get it done sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that's a great point. And one of the things I do love the velocity analogy. 3-point percentage is our velocity. And then simply put, if you don't throw 96 or whatever, you can't be in Major League Baseball anymore. And I'm not making an overstatement, but like if you can't shoot threes, corner threes, you can't play in the NBA anymore. And even if you look at like Josh Hart in this year's playoffs or Lu Dort, and these guys deserve a lot of credit for improving their jump shots to fit into today's NBA. But they're also demonstrating that it's not that hard to do this. Like, dudes can acquire that skill. And if the whole population can shoot 38% from three, what are we doing? Like, is it that impressive when a guy makes a three? Wasn't that the point? It was supposed to be sort of a side dish, and now it's the main course for most of the perimeter players in the league. And what does that do to the overall stat? Is it really that impressive? When we might, I mean, there was a time in the 80s, 90s, somebody made a 3-pointer that was exciting. And now it's just sort of just, it happens 30, 50 times a game sometimes. And, the Miami Heat go in and win a playoff game. They have no business winning because the variance monster comes out. They hit 23 threes in Boston and win a game. Is this what we want? Maybe it's not for me to say, but I do think it's really interesting to compare it to that velocity revolution in baseball, which is literally breaking their players. That's not going to happen in basketball, but it is sort of deforming the sport to an extent that is messing with scoring numbers, messing with the aesthetic. And if they move the 3-point line, I don't think you'd have five dudes standing outside the 3-point line every trip down the floor.
All right. Tell people where I guess they know where to buy it. Like they know how bookstores work, but give one final plug for Hoop Atlas.
Hoop Atlas, I'm very proud of it. It makes a great Mother's Day gift. It makes a great Father's Day gift. It makes a great bathroom companion or a coffee table decoration. It's a beautiful book. My friend and co-pilot on this is Aaron Dana. So it's got beautiful illustrations. You can find it, Bill, of course, at Amazon. You can support your lovely independent bookseller in your town or in your city. I love that. But you can get it wherever books are sold. I know that Amazon's having a sale on it right now, 23% off in a touching tribute to Michael Jordan. So go and get it. Support the cause. Support people like me and Bill. I appreciate you, Bill. I appreciate your audience for listening to this much of us ramble on about basketball when they thought they were going to get a football podcast.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Right, thanks so much to my friend Kirk Goldsberry. Check out his book, Hoop Atlas. Buy it wherever good books are sold. We have more audio coming next week. It will be a slightly less NBA-influenced show next week, but I figured it was a great time to talk about a really interesting book with the absolute quiet downtime, nothing really happening in the NFL. Thought this was the perfect time to talk about the NBA and talk about a really fun book. So hope you guys enjoyed that, and more audio coming next week here on The Bill Barnwell Show. So thanks so much for listening.